Welcome to Civil Defense Radio with your host, Preston Schlankhofer, where we talk about all things civil defense. Civil defense is about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disaster might affect you, your neighborhood, and your community. There are many threats on the horizon, yet we cannot rely on true and accurate media coverage of many of these issues. These threats are propagated from the mainstream media seeking to tell only one side of the story. In fact, this propagation can even be considered biased propaganda. This is a legitimate threat to you, your family, and our nation, and here on Civil Defense Radio, we seek the facts that others leave out. Remember, your tomorrow may depend on today's preparedness. Now, here is your host, Preston Schlankhofer.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio. I am your host, Preston Schlankhofer, coming to you from the Strategic Command and Control Center deep within the Civil Defense Radio bunker. Before we get started on our great show, I would like to ask you to help us out with the almighty algorithms. Please like, share, and comment on our shows. We really appreciate it. This helps us out a lot. And in this environment of high competition, we need to have your help to help us get new listeners. So, on with our show. This week, we have a compilation of interviews that have been done on another channel. So, in November, I was honored to be a guest on Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. The topic, of course, was civil defense. We got a lot of information in for the short time that I was on the show. We have that interview for you to begin our show this week. Our second segment of our show will be also from Secure Freedom Radio, but we will air a later two-part conversation with Frank Gaffney and Ambassador Henry Cooper. This interview with Ambassador Cooper is about protection of our nation from ballistic missile attack. I'm sure you will enjoy both of these interviews. So, both mine and Ambassador Cooper's is presented to you now, and we wish you a happy and joyous New Year.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and it's a pleasure to say we're joined for the first time by Preston Schlankhofer. He is, among other things, the owner and host of a podcast on Civil Defense Radio and the founding president of a nonprofit here in Virginia, the Civil Defense Virginia. But as important is the service that he's rendered to our country in several previous capacities, rising to the ranks of a sergeant first class with 22 years of service in the active duty reserve and Army National Guard, and thereafter over 27 years in federal law enforcement, including with Border Patrol and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He's also the Eastern Regional Director for our friend Peter Pry's EMP Task Force on National and Homeland Security. A very welcome guest. Preston, thank you very much for taking some time to talk with us today. Well, let's talk, first of all, about what would be my perspective on this, for what that's worth, is back in the early 1970s, we made an historic strategic error, I believe, as a nation, when we decided we would not defend the country against missile attack in something called the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty of that year. And one of the things that went over the side, I think inevitably, short order thereafter, was the national commitment to civil defense. I'm not sure it was ever as robust as it should have been, but if you're working to defend your people against missiles, for heaven's sakes, why bother with, you know, protecting them against other sorts of threats or, for that matter, the effects of those as well. To the extent that that has operated for all these years, how would you characterize, Preston, the state of civil defense in the United States today? First, maybe define what civil defense is, but do we actually have one?
We do not have civil defense anymore. It was changed into Department of Emergency Management, or now it's Federal Emergency Management Agency, and everybody's familiar with how FEMA has operated in all the major disasters of the last 20 years and how much of a failure it really has been for our nation and her people, especially in times of crisis. And we're headed towards other times of crises that unfortunately, you know, you've had highlights of that on your show. But we have to get back to a new form of civil defense, one that involves everybody in their own safety and protection. When I was forming Civil Defense Virginia originally, you know, in 2016, 2017, when I was putting everything together, I was looking for a good definition of civil defense. And I wasn't able to find one that really met the modern needs. So I came up with my own, which is civil defense is a system of civilians and civilian government authorities within cities and counties partnering in protective measures and emergency relief activities conducted by community members for their own safety and protection in case of severe natural or man-made disasters, including protecting families, neighborhoods, and communities, training members in disaster preparedness, response, and recovery measures, maintaining continuity of community by preserving safety, security, and constitutional governmental functions, and restoring and protecting critical infrastructure.
So this is a pretty comprehensive definition for sure, Preston Schleinkofer. But one thing that is not explicitly said, but I think most of us of an age to remember civil defense in the past, was the stockpiling of food and water and, you know, having air raid shelters or bunkers that people could repair to and the like. Is that part of what you think a modern day civil defense capability requires as well? And how far away from having any of that are we?
Well, yes. Air raid shelters, I don't know if we really, you know, there's people out there that think that we have a threat from a nuclear exchange of ICBMs, but I see that as a lesser threat. I'm more worried about an electromagnetic pulse from a nuclear device exploded above our nation and wiping out our electric grid. That, I think, is a more plausible scenario because it doesn't destroy the land, and then, you know, our adversaries can come in and mop up, and they have plenty of good land that they can cultivate. But I think preparing for all kinds of disasters, that means storing up food. You should have a minimum of 30 days. You know, the report from the Unconstrained Analytics, they did a great report, and they talk about a minimum of 2 weeks worth of food supplies in the home. And that's a good measure. There's a lot of states, especially the three along the West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington, they have a 2 week minimum supply of food and water and things like that. You have to have a rounded preparedness capability. So you have to be able to have food, water, or way to filter water. You have to be able to cook in an environment without electricity. You have to worry about heating, especially going into the winter like we are now. You got to be able to have heat. And you know, if you don't have a real fireplace, then you have to have safe ways to heat the house and cook the food. And then you have to worry about sanitation issues as well. So there's a lot of things and health issues, medical, you got to have medical supplies that meet your capability. You should have first aid training and stop the bleed training and whatever other advanced medical training you can get.
This is obviously a comprehensive list of things that we need as individuals, as families, and as communities. And hence your emphasis on continuity of communities. Talk, Preston, if you would, quickly about what continuity of community also requires and how does it help address the sorts of needs that you've just described?
Well, continuity of community needs the grassroots of the people in either city or county getting together and forming a civil defense organization. You can call it whatever you want. You know, out in Boulder, Colorado, they have this thing called BOCO Strong or BOGO Strong. You can call it whatever you want, but at the end of the day, it's still civil defense. All right. So it's a community coming together, grassroots. It's not controlled by the government because the government has their agendas, just like the old civil defense. Some administrations pumped it up and others deflated it. So then it eventually went away because they didn't think that it was a federal mandate. Well, I agree. It should be grassroots, should be community-based civil defense organizations.
And this is what you're doing with Civil Defense Virginia as a sort of template, I assume, for what you would recommend be done across the country. And so, again, to just sort of wrap this up, we are looking at the distinct possibility of disruptions, I believe, for reasons that we've discussed in the earlier segments of this show. When you see that sort of thing looming, what would you recommend people do right now? And very quickly, if you would, Preston.
Well, right now, I would buy some extra food, some shelf-stable canned goods, and you know, good foods that may not require refrigeration. I would have as much food as I can afford, and I would be coordinating with my neighbors, trying to make sure that if we're in an exposed area, that our neighbors are on board and we work together. You might even go to the sporting goods store and get some little radios.
How can people find out more about Civil Defense Virginia?
Well, they can go to civildefenseva.org, or you can go to civildefenseradio.com and the resources page. I have a guide that helps you get the discussion started on forming a civil defense organization in your city or county.
Preston Schlenkoffer, this is the first of many conversations with you. I'm delighted to make your acquaintance and have the chance to say thank you for all you've done for our country and what you're doing right now. I'd also commend to our listeners a book that is complementary to what you're talking about, I think. May have some slightly different takes on things, but may be helpful as well, called Are You Safe? You can find out how to get that for free as a downloadable PDF at securingamerica.tv. Please check it out, folks. Please come back to us again on Monday for more of Secure Freedom Radio. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio. Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Over, the better part of 30-plus years now, I've had the privilege of knowing one of the most intelligent men, one of the men who has made an outsized contribution in a variety of capacities, in government and out, to the war for the free world. He's had a clear understanding of it, and he has rendered incalculably important service in its course. His name is Ambassador Henry Cooper. He worked first, I guess, as an Air Force officer, then as a civilian in the Air Force, then as a senior official in the late and unlamented Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, then as an ambassador for President Ronald Reagan, with whom I had the privilege of serving as well, as his representative to the defense and space talks in Geneva. He went on to become the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization under the president's successor, George H.W. Bush, and has been ever since, I believe, the guiding force behind a terrific organization, High Frontier. He is a dear friend of mine and a much admired colleague, and it's great to have him with us always. Hank Cooper, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Let me ask you, Hank, because one of the things that you have really been most importantly contributing to for decades now is protecting our country against the threat of ballistic missile attack. Our boss, Ronald Reagan, famously said, you know, it's better to protect Americans than avenge them. And you have been really instrumental in your various capacities in trying to help make that possible. There was an extraordinary development, I believe last week now, that you deserve an enormous amount of credit for, even though it's something you were not directly involved in at this moment. But tell us about the latest feat of our missile defenses and what it means for perhaps the safety and security of our people.
Well, thank you, Frank. You're referring to the Aegis launch of its interceptor, the Standard Missile Block 2A, last week to intercept an ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile. The fact is that we have known it had this inherent capability since the early 1990s, actually 89 time period, when I did a special study for Secretary of Defense, then Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney, and President George H.W. Bush at the beginning of his administration of the SDI program, and trying to figure out what we were going to do as the Cold War was coming down with our missile defenses. Prior to that time, it had all been about protecting the homeland, and we changed direction then to protect not only our homeland, but our troops abroad and our friends and allies around the world. And in that context, it was clear when you looked at a globe that the ocean covers most of the world. And so it made sense to have defenses on board our ships. And therein lay the origin of the Aegis program, which I recommended and which President Bush and Secretary Cheney agreed to. And then they asked me to join forces with them as the director of the SDI program to make it happen. And we happily did. It took us over 30 years, but we finally have demonstrated that that vision is valid.
Well, it's actually been vindicated even before this. This is just the actual literal proof of what you envisioned some time ago. Remind us about an earlier demonstration, Hank, that was not against an intercontinental range ballistic missile exactly, but it proved the capability, didn't it?
Right. And leading up to that, let me just say that at the very beginning of this program, Frank Kelso, Admiral Frank Kelso, was the chief of naval operations. And when I was doing that review and advocated beginning this initiative in the Navy and persuading him to take my money when I was director of SDI to begin the Aegis BMD program, I advised him that he could not at that stage give it an ICBM capability because that was banned by the ABM treaty. We would have blocked it, would have blocked even the development and testing of the system, let alone its deployment.
That, of course, was the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty of 1972, right?
Exactly. And so that was the origin of the program, to give it a missile defense capability against short and medium range missiles. And we renamed that world the Theater Missile Defense Activity. And, of course, the Army, THAAD, and Patriot and all came along on that front. But the Navy had this important role at sea. And finally, when we got rid of the ABM Treaty, as you recall, under the George W. Bush administration, we began in a very serious way trying to press J.D. Williams, Admiral J.D. Williams, and I pressed the powers that be, and I recall going to a meeting you hosted when we were trying to get the powers that be to give it an ICBM capability even then, and that was in the mid-90s, I guess.
Well, that was before, of course, the withdrawal from the ABM treaty, but that also calls to mind, Hank, something that we partnered up on, I was very proud of at the time, with the Heritage Foundation's leadership and yours, the product that came to be called First from the Sea and Then from Space. Talk a little bit about that study, Hank, and what kind of roadmap it really laid out, starting with the Aegis.
Yeah, sure. Actually, it came in the, as you said, in the mid-90s. And it came on the heels of the Republican Newt Gingrich revolution, I'll call it, when the Republicans finally achieved majority in the House.
on a platform in part of defending the country against missile attack. That was part of the contract with America.
Well, it was, and we had we worked to make that happen. And Lowell Wood, who was the inventor of the Brilliant Pebble space-based interceptor program, and I went to Philadelphia to meet with the new Republican majority. Jack Kemp hosted us in a meeting, and with a number of others there, and we persuaded the Republicans to take this on. And the Heritage Foundation under Bob Folner, we met with Bob at the same meeting with Folner at the Ed Folner. I'm sorry, right at the same meeting, and they established a Team B. We called it at the Heritage Foundation. Asked me to lead it, and we put together a really great team to do this. And as you say, the recommendation out of this was that we needed a global defense. First from the sea and then from space.
Hank, hold the thought, because I want to come back to the space-based bit of this, but we have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more with Ambassador Henry Cooper of High Frontier on what this capability now provides us to begin protecting against ballistic missiles from foreign quarters that we didn't have before and that we urgently need and that we now must complement with space-based missile defenses that have long been in prospect, especially with Hank Cooper's leadership, but now need to be materialized. We'll be right back with Hank right after this. We're back. We're visiting for this second segment with Ambassador Henry Cooper, a distinguished public servant of many years, both in uniform and out, one of the country's great experts on the national security and real leaders as a policy and programmatic practitioner in decades of service to the country. And we've been talking with him a bit about the latest development whereby a potential capability inherent in the Navy's anti-missile, anti-aircraft system known as Aegis, has now been demonstrated against long-range, indeed intercontinental-range ballistic missiles. And this provides a tremendous potential capability to protect our country from the sea, something Hank Cooper has been advocating for, both as the former director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization and as the leader of a Team B study with the Heritage Foundation and in his role as the chairman of High Frontier. So, Hank, you were talking a bit about this space-based capability, and obviously Aegis can help us achieve a sort of interim capability, but you've long argued that the sensible, cost-effective, and militarily efficacious way to defend our country is from space. You talked a bit briefly there about Brilliant Pebbles. Remind us what that capability was and how close we were to having it and what we need to do now in space.
Well, as I said earlier, Lowell and I went to meet with the Republicans in 94, I guess it was, or maybe it was late 94, early 95. And we were advocating a global defense even then and pushed the Navy program as a prelude to a space-based system because, of course, if you have interceptors based in space, you can intercept ballistic missiles going from any place to any place else if you have the right technology. And this was, of course, Ronald Reagan's vision was what led to the SDI in the first place and why he walked out of Reykjavik in the talks in 86, I guess it was because Gorbachev wanted him to give up on that vision. Well, we were able to pursue that throughout the George H.W. Bush administration, but regrettably, when the Clinton folks came on board, they basically canceled everything.
Took the stars out of Star Wars, as I recall, is how Les Aspin put it.
The way Les Aspin put it. We were nevertheless able to keep the Navy programs going thanks to our friends on the Hill, not necessarily in the administration, but we kept that going. And that extended even into the George W. Bush era when we had some problems inside the Pentagon of keeping the Navy program going. But we had colleagues and friends on the Hill throughout that time period to keep that happening. Nevertheless, we're unsuccessful in restarting any serious program
program to build a space-based interceptor system, and that regrettably is still where we stand today. Nevertheless, it is the most capable system. And since Jim Abramson's tour as the first director of SDI, it was recognized to be the most effective and least expensive way to build a missile defense program. But we have been obstructed every step of the way because of the arms control community and their concerns about so-called militarization of space. And never mind that ICBMs traverse space and it's already been militarized in the World War II.
And in fact, our enemies have no compunction about using space for military purposes, including taking out our satellites and that sort of thing. But Hank, this brings us back to the ABM Treaty, because it's not something probably remembered even by our highly educated audience. But that treaty, it malingers, I think is the verb, even though it was ended formally by George W. Bush, thanks in no small measure to your effort. Talk a little bit about why it is that we continue to find ourselves constrained, at least by the sort of premise of it, which is that having effective defenses, including in space, is a bad thing for our country.
Well, I can't explain to you or defend that proposition, but I can tell you that already in the wake of this magnificent test of the Navy this past week, the arms control community in some quarters is coming up on the net saying, oh, this is going to be terrible because it will provoke an arms race and da-da-da-da-da. It's the same old story that we heard in Geneva and by the so-called scientific community at the time during the Reagan years, fed back by the Soviets to us, that this would end all arms control. It would lead to a war in space. Militarization of space became the title for it. And now they're using that same theme because of the inherent capability of a sea-based defense to protect our homeland as well as our troops and so on abroad. Most people don't realize it, but we have ships that are always near our coast. And quite frankly, now we know that they could defend our northeastern part of the United States, in particular against missiles from North Korea and the rest of the country, depending on where the ships are. And they don't have to be tethered to do this. This is a misnomer as well. The Navy is concerned about not being tethered to the land. But in fact, ships in Norfolk can defend the northeastern corridor against and far less expensive than building a site somewhere up in the Northeast.
This is hugely important. But Hank, let me just drill down on this proposition, because as best I can tell, and we had a terrific conversation with a longtime colleague of both of ours, Dr. Mark Schneider, on Monday, I believe, where we visited about the buildup that has been taking place in the Chinese Communist Party's military. This alone belies the idea that if we only refrain from having effective missile defenses, we'll somehow keep others hostile to us from accumulating more and more threatening capabilities. Let's talk about China for a minute, Hank. What is your assessment of, well, among other things, this study by the Pentagon of Chinese military power, which otherwise seemed to be pretty well done, but it insists that the Chinese only have something like 29 or so nuclear warheads. Does that sound right to you, given what we've seen them doing, including building 3,000 miles of hardened underground tunnels to house their ballistic missiles and heavens knows what all else?
No, it doesn't make sense as far as I'm concerned. And by the way, I've been in some of those underground tunnels, and I can tell you they're proliferated throughout China. And furthermore, the Chinese, while we ignored the products of the SDI program, and in fact, the Clinton administration, as you said, took the stars out of Star Wars, the Chinese actually adapted and have exploited the so-called Brilliant Pebbles technologies. We wrote about this in other studies that I was party to, 15, 20 years ago. So, I mean, China's been on this on the right side of the technology for years, and I consider it to be a bigger threat to us because of their economic power now than Russia. So, yes, China's a big deal.
Let me turn to Russia, though, Hank, since you've mentioned it. There's been talk lately about having a nuclear freeze with Russia. You and I remember fighting vigorously against such an idea during the Reagan administration. Then as now, actually even more acute of a problem today, is they have essentially completed the most comprehensive force buildup in the history of the world, I think it's fair to say. According to Mark Schneider, I believe they've put in place something like 26 different nuclear systems, essentially completing an overhaul of what was already a pretty formidable force. We, by contrast, Hank, as you know so well, have essentially obsolescent, if not actually obsolete, nuclear forces that are due for modernization, but heavens knows how long it's going to take actually to accomplish it, and if at the end of the day there will be such a modernization. There's talk about, from Adam Smith, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, that the Biden administration, if there is one, will take us down to a single force, a monad, as opposed to a triad. Talk a little bit about what the Russians are seemingly doing, and the inadvisability of further restricting our own modernization programs in this regard.
Well, it's crazy. I mean, what we're up to is crazy, and I fear for our kids and grandkids and now great grandkids, for me, because if the Biden administration does it comes in, and they do, as you suggested. Let me just say, just to exaggerate, not to exaggerate, but to emphasize the point that you've made. The Russians told the EMP Commission, I don't know, 20 years ago, that they had, quote, accidentally, unquote, given to the North Koreans how to build a super EMP weapon, which is a low-yield weapon that's been clearly tested over the years. And, of course, the Chinese have it as well.
It's an electromagnetic pulse weapon, of course.
Correct. And these are low-yield devices that create lots of gamma rays, and that's what creates the electromagnetic pulse in our around the world, actually, depending on where it's located. And we have not developed those kinds of weapons ourselves. And there is a misnomer out there that you've got to have very high-yield weapons in order to create the EMP. Well, you don't. A very low-yield weapon is quite adequate to produce an existential threat to all Americans. It could destroy our electric power grid and leave us in darkness for a year. And with that, most Americans would die from starvation and just chaos, the chaos that would result. So, I mean, this is an existential threat, and not only China has this, but the North Koreans have it as well. And quite frankly, I believe Iran has it also. So we have been whistling by the graveyard now for decades by not, A, producing a counter capability to threaten a response to those who threaten us, but to defending against it.
Defending against it is the operative word, I think, and your leadership in that regard, Hank, has been incalculably important. And thank you most especially for bringing us to the point where the Aegis system has now been validated, as you long envisioned it could be, as an effective means of protecting our country against ballistic missile threats for EMP purposes, among others. Hank, bless you. It's so good to talk with you, and thank you for your time today. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Well, we hope you enjoyed these three segments, one of mine and two of Ambassador Cooper, on Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. I get a lot of information from Gaffney's show and his websites and participation in the Secure the Grid Coalition, which is an organization within the Center for Security Policy. So, civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with the guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com, right at the top. Be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook, Twitter, on MeWe, and Parler, and also our page on YouTube, which is at Civil Defense Radio Podcast. So I wish to thank you for being with us this week. It's really a pleasure having you here, and we wish you a happy new year and a great 2021, because we know how bad and how much 2020 sucked. So it is with great pleasure to have you here and to sign off on this show. So please be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.